This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, a family disintegrates in increasingly horrifying ways in Hereditary, while Sandra Bullock and co. plan a Met Gala heist in Ocean's 8.
But we will start with the living nightmare that is Hereditary, Ari Aster's debut movie that actually debuted back at Sundance earlier this year and was picked up by A24, thus becoming the new entry in the growing list of horror films from A24 that are really just knocking it out of the park. You know, follows in the same vein as The Witch most recently. This is of similar tone and similar disturbance. I hesitate to call Hereditary an out-and-out horror film because I think on its own merits, taken as a serious drama about a family dealing with grief, it actually works really, really well in that right, completely separate from the horror aspect. And it's anchored by Toni Collette's just absolutely phenomenal performance. She plays a woman whose mother recently passes away, and it's just basically the fallout from that. They have the son played by Alex Wolff, who's just kind of becoming distant and walking around smoking weed all the time. The father played by Gabriel Byrne, who is very, very good in this, and I really miss this guy. I just wish he would do more films that allow him to sink his teeth in some ways. But this really is the Toni Collette show, and you know, just watching how the all this grief just kind of unspools, and I think that's really where the horror of the film comes from. And because of that, and I don't want this to sound like it's a knock against the film in any way, but it wasn't scary to me so much as it was just deeply, deeply uncomfortable, because that horror was actually coming from such a real place, and it really just like it sinks its teeth in early, and it really you don't feel good about any of it. There's like a pit in your stomach, even when it's not scary, even when it's not even trying to be scary, it really just wears on you and chips away at your brain. And after, you know, obviously a lot has been made about the final act of this film just going, you know, into complete insanity, and it does, but it also feels unfortunately very organic, and it really came across as realistic, which was the most disturbing part about it. And it's not all like, you know, this super histrionic or even something in the vein of what Darren Aronofsky's Mother was earlier last year. It's just something that feels like a natural progression of this story in a realistic way, and it really just burrows in a way that really kind of kicks you in the chest.
Yeah, and I've definitely, it's funny you bring up Mother, because I was literally just thinking about that, and I was going to bring it up, because I've heard a lot of people reverence Mother in regards to this film, because it is basically a nutso third act, which is really, you know, sort of leaves the impact on you as an audience member. But basically, you know, the film, you know, it's sort of very slow and methodical for much of the first half, you know, and it really does focus on that family dramatic aspect, and then it just builds and builds with lots of teases and build up to that sort of crazy third act. But basically, I think the film basically takes, you know, it's a very unique film, and I don't think I've seen anything quite like it, but basically what it does is it takes a lot of elements that you may recognize from previous horror films and presents them in a way that is unexpected, or presents them in a way that you haven't really seen them presented before. And I think the most striking element of this film that really made me enjoy it, and I think that a lot of, you know, critics are really harking on, is the cinematography, which is absolutely unbelievable at times. And I think, and the reason I bring it up is because it does a lot of foreshadowing, where there, you know, the camera sort of you know, just glides around the house and moves slowly, or into a visual that will tease something to come later. There's this symbol, which we won't say what it means, but there's lots of this, like, you know, the camera goes by a telephone pole and there's the symbol on it. Those of you who've seen the movie know what that leads to. There's other things, like the simple things, like there's an individual where it's like at the mailbox on the front door, and there's like a seance flyer that just goes. It's just simple shots where it's like there's nothing before it, nothing after. It's just a simple standalone shot that he throws in there that I think makes the film that much more effective, as it's teasing these elements, not, you know, oh, exposition, oh yeah, I've always wanted to try a seance or something like that. It's just a simple way of putting the idea in the audience's mind, not treating them like an idiot, and then having that come up later on. I mean, you obviously mentioned the act in the film, which is obviously another of the film's strengths. A lot of people have been talking about Toni Collette, you know, for award season. I would definitely agree with that. Unfortunately, I think it's an argument that might be impossible to win, although I can hope in this day and age that people would be more open to it. But I just know that people, when it comes to horror films, they're not open-minded in that sense, even though, obviously, as you alluded to, we've had a collection of seriously incredibly made by incredible filmmakers horror films, particularly indie horror films, in recent years, and there are many I could list off in that regard. But, you know, Toni Collette is really incredible in this and definitely deserving of praise, as is, you know, Gabriel Byrne is with. He's more of like the straight man where he's like, you know, he recognizes that things are not right and he doesn't want to go down these dark paths that these other characters do. Alex Wolff is also really good from his facial expressions. That's the thing. The cinematography combines with the acting to sort of as the sort of the perfect relationship, whereas, you know, there are no perfect familiar relationships to be found, you know, in this thing where, you know, the cinematography really focuses on the facial expressions of these characters. And then obviously later on in the film, the cinematography is used. I loved how, you know, you mentioned how it wasn't particularly scary. I think it's just a really tense experience where it's like, for me, I don't judge horror films based on the scariness factor. Obviously, there should be some creepy elements to it or whatever, but for me, it's hard to really scare me in this day and age. But, you know, I alluded to this, you know, after I saw the film, where like at the end of the film, after it was over, I tried to stand up and I was like, a little uneasy. And that's the best argument I can make for this film, where I didn't feel that scared, although towards the end, I was definitely feeling tense and different elements. And I was like, oh man, I don't know where this is going. But you just stand up and you're like, you just know you've experienced something special. And that's the biggest takeaway from Hereditary. It's definitely something special and worth checking out if you're into, you know, non-traditional ways of horror, I guess is the best way to put it.
That's definitely the case here. I think, you know, I read an interview with Astor and he was talking about how he wrote this movie when he was, you know, after some personal tragedies in his life. And, you know, that kind of, I really don't know what it is. I want to respect his privacy and not even surmise what it might have been, because the grief in this film feels very, very palpable. And it's just, you know, I mentioned earlier that it was, it almost plays as, like, if you play it straight as a drama, it would be just as effective of a film. Now that I'm thinking about it, there is this layer of dread that comes over, you know, every frame of this, and I think a lot of that is actually a credit to the production design. For those of you who didn't know, this film was actually built on a soundstage. They did not use a location for this. They really recreated this house in a soundstage, and that obviously allows them more freedom with blocking the actors and the action and the camera movements, and that all these little nuances that are more style, that are the result of stylistic choices, and, you know, obviously the score plays a lot into this, really elevated above what would have been, you know, standard prestige fare, or, you know, an even straight horror fare. Like you said, this is a really tough, tense film to sit through, and it's really not for everyone. If you're going in expecting something of the Boo variety, I think The Purge is coming out in a couple weeks. Not that that doesn't look fun too, but, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and obviously, you know, these types of films, you know, these types of independent horror films in recent years, like a lot of mainstream audiences, and I'm sorry, they just aren't going to be able to appreciate it, because, you know, I've been thinking about this. I mean, I don't want to get too philosophical here or whatever, but I've been thinking about this more and more lately, and how a lot of audiences and movie audiences in general have been conditioned to expect certain things from movies and sort of put movies in a box. And what I love about film is that there are filmmakers willing to push films outside that box and willing to push narratives in different unexpected directions, or use different elements like cinematography and lighting to really get across the expressive qualities that a film can really express to an audience. So, you know, this is definitely the type of film made for a specific audience. Obviously, we are in that audience, which should shock no one that listens to this podcast on a regular basis. But all I can say is go in with an open mind, you know, and try and, you know, be able to experience the film as intended by the filmmaker. I know it's certainly tougher for certain audiences than others who don't have the time that we do just to watch all these crazy films and really experience this, but, you know, this is the type of film that pushes, you know, the boundaries of what film can be in the best way possible, particularly the genre of horror. I also want to mention that this film continues one of my absolute favorite horror traditions by certain film, not in the case of every horror film, but it continues one of my favorite traditions of choosing an end credit song that's sort of very tongue-in-cheek and ironic to everything. Obviously, I won't spoil what that song is, but I just wanted to point that out because I love it, love, love it when horror films do that. I think back to, you know, Sam Raimi's original Evil Dead, which sort of ends almost like a vaudeville tune. So it's almost like, oh, flayed off, oh, there you go. You just experience that. I don't know, there's something about that to me. I just, you know, I've always been a fan of horror comedy in general, and obviously this film does not have comedic leanings at all, but I don't know, I just wanted to point that out, because it's one of my favorite things that horror filmmakers do. It really leaves you with an impact. It makes you feel like you experience something special. And then one last thing I wanted to mention about the film is this is a really great set piece, although it's calling it a set piece is a bit much, but this is really fantastic dinner table scene where, you know, you talked about how a lot of it plays more like a family drama and, you know, through the grieving process and stuff like that throughout much of the film. And there's this fantastic dinner table scene where the tension building between Tony Gaw's mother and Alex's son really builds over, and Gabriel Byrne's there and just as sort of an innocent bystander. And it just the way it's acted and the way it intensely feels. I just think people heading into this film expecting, you know, something of the Boo variety, you know, seeing something like this will be like, why is this happening? But the scene is absolutely incredible. And it's a credit to the filmmaker Ari Aster and the actors that it was so effective. But honestly, I mean, this is easily in contention, you know, easily one of the best films of the year to date. And I definitely highly recommend it for more discerning audiences. And for more mainstream audiences, you know, just try and go in with an open mind, because I think you can definitely get something out of this film, as it's definitely a very unique experience, to say the least.
And special mention to character actress Anne Dowd in this film, who shows up in just about everything lately, but most notably on The Leftovers and The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. You know, it's funny you mentioned the ironic song choice in the end credits, because you know, maybe this is why my own film screenwriting career has failed so miserably. It's because I come up with imagery in my head and then nothing else around that. I am all style, no substance. But I always had this idea of ending a movie, like a horror movie, or maybe in my head it was a nuclear holocaust movie or some kind of political something or other. But I wanted to end it with The World is Waiting for the Sunrise by Les Paul and Mary Ford, just because it has that, you know, super upbeat tone. And I just wanted it to be that, you know, beacon of light in the tongue in the cheek of that very, very bitter film. And this is, and like you, I am a fan of that device, and maybe someday I'll actually get to execute that myself.
But with that in mind, I think we can transition. I just want to touch on one news story, film news story, that's really for the film aficionados out there. Because for those of you who don't know the story of filmmaker Terry Gilliam, obviously known for being part of the Monty Python crew, but has had a fantastic career in his own right as a filmmaker. If you think about such films, you know, I always automatically go to Brazil, such a very unique artistic vision from a filmmaker with constant unique artistic visions. But for those of you who don't know, Terry Gilliam has been trying to make, you know, his Don Quixote Hill film for such a long time, and he's had so many starts and stops with this project. You know, infamously, there's a documentary made about him trying to make the film, you know, that was starring Johnny Depp at the time and all this stuff. But now comes, you know, this year was finally the hope that, oh, the man from, you know, whatever the official title of the film is called, you know, there's been so many iterations, I'm getting them all mixed up in my brain right now. But whatever Terry Gilliam's Quixote film is called, you know, it premiered, you know, at Cannes, you know, got a pretty good reception, although not overwhelmingly positive. There's definitely been a bit of mixed reception, but essentially the film has been made, you know, with, you know, Adam Driver and Jonathan Pryce in the titular role. But unfortunately, recently Terry Gilliam lost a court battle and now has lost the rights to the film, even though it's already been made, already been shown at Cannes, and even released in certain areas of the world. And this has sort of thrown its distribution into limbo. Essentially, what happened was Terry Gilliam, you know, previously had a written agreement with a producer who was supposed to fund, you know, the film, and Terry Gilliam went to him before the production and he didn't provide him with funds. So Terry Gilliam just went off and made the film. But unfortunately, the court ruled in this other guy's favor, you know, who is now, you know, just saying ridiculous things. I recommend you looking up the case if you want to, because I'm not even going to dignify this guy's name on this podcast, because I have such disdain for this guy who essentially is continuing film history repeating itself with Terry Gilliam's Don Quixote not being able to be released. And it's just frustrating. I mean, there's nothing concrete now. There could be deals made. We don't know exactly what's happening here. But if this loser, and I'll say it, this loser doesn't let Terry Gilliam release his film at this point in time, I understand, you know, there's lots of different financial aspects to it and all that, and, you know, different legal stuff. But at this point, if you can't give Terry Gilliam, who's had, you know, some health struggles in recent years, just let him release this film finally an artist like Terry Gilliam. I don't even want to hear your name ever again for the rest of my life, because this just needs to be released and we need to have this over with. Terry Gilliam needs that closure, damn it.
Yeah, you just kind of feel for the guy. I mean, this is turning into The Clown Who Cried at this point. It's a movie that's just might never even get seen by American audiences. It's just disappointing. Like you said, he's had health issues. I think he actually had a heart attack the day after the movie premiered last month. So it really sucks. I mean, this is a very arduous journey that's been going on. And honestly, it couldn't have been more on the nose if he was adapting the myth of Sisyphus to screen. But Don Quixote is still sufficient. It's just depressing, and my heart breaks for the guy. I mean, obviously, you know, these are rich people with rich people problems, but at the end of the day, the guy is a serious artist, and I just feel bad that he's not getting what he has labored on for God only knows how many years now, pushing 15, 20, something like that, to not have that effort be rewarded, at least by an impartial viewing by all audiences possible. It's really just disappointing to see.
Definitely. But with that in mind, I guess we can transition to our second film of the day, and certainly very different in tone to Hereditary. And of course, I'm talking about Gary Ross's Ocean's 8, which is the latest entry into the sort of Ocean's franchise, although certainly most people wouldn't view this as sort of completely necessarily to be made or anything. But I think people just had to mind, oh, we can get together this fantastic, you know, cast of actresses and showcase them. And I think for the most part, the film is just sort of a solid, enjoyable summer popcorn flick. You know, as I said, it doesn't feel completely necessary, and I will say for much of the first half of the film, I thought it felt at times almost too lightweight for its own good. The film definitely picks up in its latter half and is greatly elevated by one performance in particular, and I don't think you'll be shocked to know who I'm going to say. Anne Hathaway is incredible in this movie. And typically, you know, for this sort of lightweight popcorn movie, you wouldn't typically say that, you know, where it'd be, oh, there's this performance that greatly elevates this solid popcorn flick, but she really does here. She is fantastic playing this sort of, you know, starlet Daphne Kluger, who is sort of, you know, intertwined into the plot. She's so good in this role. And any of you who've seen the trailers, you can sort of pick up on the type of character, you know, she's sort of playing here. But the way she plays it at different points in this movie, I just couldn't help but chuckle to myself, because I thought she was so effing good in this role. And that's not to say anything bad about the rest of the cast. You know, Sandra Bullock does good solidly in the lead role, sort of the George Clooney role. She's essentially playing his sister, you know, Danny Ocean's sister or whatever in this. And she essentially gets the team together. I did feel like Cate Blanchett was a bit underutilized. You know, I feel like the script in some places, you know, it definitely could have, you know, added, you know, as I said, it feels a bit lightweight in places, although I feel like that's definitely the intention with this film. But I feel like some of the characters and actresses could have been used more, such as, you know, an actress the quality of someone like Cate Blanchett. But people like, I think Helena Bonham Carter is really good as well, playing the Irish fashion designer. She's just has that nervous energy that is just sort of perfect for this role. But I just keep coming back to Anne Hathaway, because she is so good in this film. And anyone who sees this movie and doesn't, like, can't recognize that, I don't know what you were watching, because she is amazing.
Absolutely. This is the Anne Hathaway show as far as I'm concerned. And this is a performance that I actually think, not that I'm saying it would make my final five, but I think it definitely needs to be in contention for supporting actress talk comes year end. The movie overall is fun, and it's funny, and there's some genuine laughs in there, and it's breezy and light, and every once in a while, that's just the kind of movie that I need. And, you know, you mentioned that the movie is slight. It totally is. And I guess the one negative that I'll knock the film for is that Gary Ross is really not the right filmmaker for this type of movie. I think he has this very mannered, prestige-y approach, as evidenced by his films Seabiscuit and Pleasantville. Not exactly these, you know, rockin' and rollin', high-stakes heist films. I feel that, and I can't even think of anyone off the top of my head, but just someone with more, like, forward motion or more oomph to their style would have dragged a little bit more out of this, and forgiven the fact that it is, as you said, just a breezy popcorn film. And like I said, we need those breezy popcorn films sometimes. And the joy in watching this film is watching the performers actually have fun. And I really enjoyed Awkwafina, the one of the, basically who's hired by Sandra Bullock and Cate Blanchett as like the sleight of hand who's in there to steal this necklace that's off the back of Daphne Kluger's neck at the Met Gala. And I think it's a really unique setting. It's almost like we're being led into a world that, you know, you and I, even if we could, you know, rub elbows with those types of people, probably wouldn't want to go to something like this anyway. But it's fun, you know, to walk on the moon for a night, as it were. It's you know, in the way when the heist eventually plays out, I think, you know, the first three Ocean's films had the same problem where the first half of the film, and they, you know, I'll even throw Logan Lucky into this to an extent, where the first half of the film, there's just so much setting up that it really does drag down a little bit. But once it actually gets to the heist portion, it becomes immensely, immensely entertaining. And that's where it gets that breeziness and that, you know, the sleight of hand and filmmaking technique that is really entertaining, at least in the case of Logan Lucky. That first half actually paid off towards the end. Can't say the same thing about this, but it is still really fun to watch. But also be wary that the title is a spoiler if you're even remotely good at math.
I was thinking about that the whole time. I was like, all right, who is the eighth member? And I thought it paid off perfectly. Obviously, we won't spoil that for you, but I thought it was the right choice. And that leads to a couple of more great scenes. You know, you mentioned, you know, oh, I couldn't think of a filmmaker, you know, to replace Gary Ross. Well, you just alluded to the perfect filmmaker for this. Well, yeah. The obvious choice, Soderbergh, who directed the original Ocean trilogy. But people have justly pointed out, if you've seen Ocean Date or you watch it, you know, it's clear Gary Ross is trying to do some Soderbergh-type things. And him and Soderbergh, I know they've had a relationship. I know they've worked on projects previously together before, so I know they have sort of close relationships. He was trying sort of to do that. But if Soderbergh just did this, and obviously, you know, he's interested in doing lots of more unique things now, so I think that he probably didn't have the cling to, oh, come back to do another Ocean story. But I think he would have been, you know, a perfect choice. But yeah, I mean, the film, like, that's the thing. The film was so breezy. I don't really have too much to say, and we can't really say too much about the second half of the film because it would get into a bit spoilers, obviously. With most heist films, you know, this isn't, you know, one of the best heist films I've seen, but it's solid, and it's elevated, really, by the cast of characters, and particularly, obviously, the actresses I already mentioned. You know, and I've always, like, enjoyed heist films, and I think it goes down a unique path. That's just fun to see the characters interact. I don't know. It's just sort of, you know, I mean, I can't really say much more than it's a breezy popcorn summer flick with an ensemble of great female actresses, and it's just fun, and it isn't much more than that. And I can certainly understand why people certainly weren't clamoring for another Ocean's film or anything like that. It's definitely not necessary, but as you said, sometimes, you know, it's just the type of film you need at certain points, you know. And obviously, we watch a lot of films, as you can tell by this podcast, so sometimes you just need some breezy entertainment, and this film definitely fulfills that.
Especially in a week where we also had to sit through Hereditary. You know, I actually just thought of a filmmaker that would have, and you know, this is kind of a cop out because he did have something resembling a heist film coming out last year in Edgar Wright. You know, obviously the Baby Driver is a completely, completely different beast than Ocean's 8. Ocean's 8 being more of a comedy, Baby Driver just being, you know, a balls out action film. But I want someone who has that kind of panache and that kind of penchant for editing and penchant for pacing that I think Edgar Wright does. And obviously that's, you know, that's like saying, well, you know, I guess this movie's pretty good, but it's no 2001 Space Odyssey or something like that. But yeah, it's fun. And with that in mind, we can turn to two other movies next week that are probably going to be pretty fun too, in Brad Bird's The Incredibles and the swear to God true story, somehow against all odds, of Tag.
That's The Incredibles 2, Ryan, in case you're sticklers for, you know, putting the 2 at the end there. But obviously, we'll talk to you guys again next week with our thoughts on Incredibles 2 and Tag.